podcast, we've spent much of the past year investigating the collapse of the news media and the decline in public trust. My guest on today's program argues that the industry is at a crossroads, but media bosses are unwilling to meet the moment and are determined to continue on the same trajectory, even if it means the death of their institutions. Ryan Zickraff is an American journalist and a columnist at Compact Magazine. His new essay is Journalism's Slow Death Threatens Democracy. Ryan Zickraff is my guest today on Lean Out. Ryan, welcome to Lean Out.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Very nice to have you on. I was excited to read your latest column for Compact Magazine. And in that piece, you write that the news business's slow death spiral should alarm us across political divides. And you outlined several crises that have converged to create a pretty dire moment. Walk us through the situation that newsrooms in America find themselves in right now.
Well, yeah. I think the crisis that's getting a lot of attention right now is that the business of news, which has been failing, you know, slowly for the last generation, in the last few years, sort of really hit a new low. And the lack of ad dollars, the lack of subscriptions, and just capital in general being invested elsewhere is causing a lot of layoffs in the industry and a lot of news outlets to shutter altogether. So a lot of the places that we know on the web from the 2010s are gone. And a lot of the big outlets like the LA Times, NPR, all sorts of outlets nationally are losing staff. So we just don't have as much news as we did even a few years ago.
And you write in the piece that media's big bosses seem unwilling to meet the moment. What do you mean by that?
Well, I just mean that 2023 and then going into 2024 is a real crisis moment, I think, for the state of news. And so we should be really rethinking that a lot of the things that we do. And instead, I find that a lot of journalism's thinkers are kind of relying on the same sort of, you could call it progressive or liberal take on how to adjust to the changing news landscape. And a lot of it is that the news has to get more diverse, not the news itself, but the people that work on it, the reporters, the editors should be more diverse, and that we should be more partisan, mostly towards Democrats. We should be more liberal. We should really tell the truth about Trump, which apparently we hadn't been fully doing for the last 7 years. Now we have to really go after him. So there's this sort of obsession with these two sort of planks, to way to get the media back to where it was. And I just don't think it's really working.
I would agree. Let's pick that apart for a moment. So the diversity issue, so you start with the diversity issue and you say that there is an over DEI going on. What is over DEIing?
The DEI administrations that have popped up in the last 5-10 years, you know, a lot of them actually started out with a good point in that the media was dominated by a lot of white guys like myself. And, you know, there was a correction to that. There has been a correction to that since I've been a journalist now for 25 years. And the way that the media looks from when I started is definitely changed, and a lot of it's for the better. But there's sort of this obsession with what, you know, a lot of people will say marginalized communities. And these progressive news organizations don't see a stopping point necessarily in DEI. That, like, okay, we have a certain group that's represented, and once we hit this goal, then we can sort of loosen that. We don't have to make sure that our hiring is just women or just people of color. We can sort of relax that. But for a lot of these organizations, they don't know when to stop. You know, as I mentioned in my column, there's no George Bush on the aircraft carrier doing mission accomplished. They're not like, we did it. So you have these progressive media organizations that are suddenly 75% women, or they're hiring 70% people of color. And so for all the talk about diversity, it's actually becoming less diverse than it was. And it's just, well, you know, these organizations have these DEI. They're not going to say, well, I'm not needed anymore. These DEI executives aren't going to retire. So there's continued pressure on them to keep hiring. But like, what are you actually getting out of it?
And also on the class front, I mean, we just saw something from Neiman this week showing that the masthead of the New York Times has a very high proportion of people coming from the Ivy Leagues, right? And so as we're diversifying more racially, which is a good thing, we're becoming less diverse in terms of class.
Yeah. And another point I make in my column is that a disproportionate amount of the media is coming from certain big cities, New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta. All of these cities are overrepresented in the media. And part of that is because local news itself is dying way faster than these national and regional publications. So you and I used to rely more on local news to kind of tell us what was going on in the world. And these publications tended to be nonpartisan for the most part, except for the editorial page. But what's happened, you know, especially in the last 10 or 15 years, is that because local media has shrunk or died, regional and national take more of the airspace, and they're made up of people that tend to be Ivy Leaguers. They tend to live in these big cities. So what they report on tends to reflect their interests.
And just returning to the Trump point that you made a few minutes ago and unpacking that, I just want to read a section from your piece, which was really striking to me. Rather than calling for more trustworthy institutions reflecting a national consensus, too many in the mainstream are responding the same way they have since 2016, by demanding more diversity, as we've just spoken to, and more overtly anti-Trump rhetoric to match the combative tenor of right-wing media, the equivalent of cutting off their nose to spite their face. New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen, for example, has essentially called for news media's equivalent of martial law due to Trump's anti-democratic tendencies. To fix this, he says, you would have to call a halt to regular journalism, suspend your routines. And you write, can't we just call Trump a fascist liar in every headline? Talk to me a little bit about that dynamic, particularly as we go into this new election season.
You know, the Trump presidency was an interesting time in journalism where there was a big shift in the way that news was presented. You know, there were calls in the media for, let us drop objectivity and let us tell the truth about Trump in certain ways that the media never really did before. It was sort of like, this is an emergency, and so we need to do journalism in a way that reflects an emergency. But as it happened, there was definitely unusual things with the Trump presidency. Don't get me wrong. You know, his presidency was unlike any other, but a lot of it was messaging and norms that were political norms that were violated. If you look at what actually happened during those 4 years, it wasn't that extraordinary. As far as like policy changes, giant wars to be entered or not, it really didn't change that much. And so there was this weird, you know, when Trump left and then Biden came in, there was this sort of exhaling, and then people like dropped off. A lot of the public stopped paying attention. They're like, We just had these 4 years where we were panicked. It felt like an emergency. It turned out that the biggest emergency was COVID, right? And COVID was something that started in the Trump presidency and continued in the Biden administration. And what resulted wasn't really that different from each other. So everybody was like, well, okay, COVID's over. We have Biden in. And they just sort of have disconnected from the news. Well, we're in a weird period now, like during the campaign season where it's really kicking on. And the media is hungry for attention and clicks. And so they're going back to the well and they're like, we're back to an emergency. Oh, and by the way, this is an emergency that's even worse than last time. Because, oh, actually, fascism is going to happen. We keep getting these, you know, calls that we have to look for 1933 Nazi Germany to find out what's happening in America right now. We have books like this Rural Rage book that just came out. We have the Civil War movie coming out, and a lot of people are taking that as sort of a preview of what's going to happen if Trump is elected. So we're really in this crying wolf period of the news. And so a lot of journalism's masters are saying, this is what needs to happen because we're sleepwalking towards fascism. And this is the way, this is our responsibility as journalists to describe, you know, give a sense of what the Trump administration is be like at. And for most of us, we look at it and we just feel like it's very disconnected from reality.
And there are some cooler heads out there on this discussion. I mean, your point about public policy, Matthew Iglesias made that recently at the Stony Brook journalism panel that featured him and Musa Algarbi, who was hosting it. He's a Compact Magazine columnist as well, and James Bennett. And on that panel, there was really interesting conversation just about the proportionality of Trump coverage. And so Musa pointed out from his work for the Columbia Journalism Review that Trump was the fourth most frequent used word in the New York Times in 2018, if you filter out the and those kind of things. This is across sports. This is across fashion. I mean, going forward, how do we avoid that kind of disproportionate coverage of a topic like Trump?
I think it's a good question. And I think that's something that journalism actually needs to reckon with. Instead of saying that we have to keep obsessing over him and make every article about him, we have to part of the problem is the business model, right? The business model has been wrecked because of the internet and the way that all of our news gets flattened onto this device that we can use to watch Netflix, TikTok, and then consume news. And so I think what happens a lot is that the news that is most useful and it takes nuance just doesn't get the attention. And because of the way that the news business is driven by the attention economy, we're not incentivized necessarily to sort of rethink, okay, just because people are a certain percentage of our readers are really into this. Because that's another thing is that because of the way that we consume news, outlets can see what articles are getting clicked. It reproduces itself and you end up writing more pieces that will be click driven. And I think most people know that, but the problem is because the business is so bad, how do you pivot towards a more sort of nutritious news diet? And I don't think that a lot of people have the answers right now, but it's something that definitely should be discussed.
But what about Substack? I mean, you raised Substack in the piece. Substack has doubled its paid subscribers. This is something the legacy press does not want to talk about at all. What is, say, Substack giving the public that the legacy press is not? And of course, I'm biased here because I am on Substack. So,
okay, there you go. I am too, although I haven't written in a while. I think that the liberal media, which would still probably consider themselves very independent, has become more of a documenter, a supporter, even if not blatantly, overtly, of the Democratic Party. And so there is a hunger out there for alternative voices. Not only that, because of the business model so bad, and the fact that there's not many paid movie or music reviewers out there, like arts criticism is dead, essentially. There's not much food writing out there anymore. So there's just a lot of things because of the contraction of the media that just isn't covered. And so a part of that is more moderate centrist and a certain part of the right. Now there's a certain part of the right that does get covered by media outlets, but it tends to be more of an extremist part of the right. And so I think that, so it fulfills this niche of people getting information that isn't there's no editor that works in New York or DC that's saying, here are the list of stories that you can write about, and here's your angles. I mean, I think a lot of people that maybe don't work in journalism don't realize actually how much power that editors have. And I see that all the time when I'm pitching stories to editors, you know, what I pitch that gets picked, that they'll pay me to do and whatnot. So I think that Substack, because it's very free and open, that it gives a lot of writers and journalists opportunities to write things that there's no market for otherwise. So that part's really cool. The downside, I think, is that there's a bit of a balkanization where a lot of us online have very niche news diets, and there's little sense of sort of a shared culture anymore. And I think that's, you know, happening in all parts of the culture, and information and news is just part of that. But sometimes it just feels like we're all this atomized, very individualized version of the news, where you can kind of take a cafeteria style approach to it. And so we can't agree upon truth. And I'm not sure. And I think that gets worse with AI.
Yes, indeed. I want to close by just talking a little bit about where we go from here. But before we get to that, you told a very striking anecdote from your recent panel at the Columbia Journalism Conference that involved a member of the public. I do want to just touch on that because I think it's quite emblematic of some of the trends we're seeing. Can you just tell that story now here?
Oh, sure. Last month, I spoke at a Columbia Journalism panel on sort of the future, the 2024 elections and the future of news. And a lot of the arguments that were made are what I talked about earlier, that, you know, with the DEIing the news and let's call out Trump for what he is, news. But what was striking to me is I sat at a table for lunch. There was a lunch break between the panels. The public was invited to this talk. Not many, it was almost all journalists. You know, there was probably a handful of people from the public that came. And there was this older Black lady who ended up sitting at my table with other panelists. And she was very outspoken. She wanted to engage with us. But what was interesting is that she didn't explicitly say she was a Trump supporter, but she was Trump leaning. And she had only bad things to say about Biden and Obama. Well, what I noticed is, you know, at my table, there was a DEI executive who worked for like a press institute, and then an author who wrote a book called Anti-Racist Journalism. But they could barely look at her in the eye when she was talking about why she didn't like Barack Obama and why she liked Trump. They just couldn't engage. They just didn't know what to say. They were like a frozen rabbit, you know, with a wolf in the room. So that kind of spoke to me about, you know, with all this talk about like hearing about who our audience is and like underserved audiences and marginalized people, you know, to me, it kind of said who among this group that they're really going for, you know, that a lot of journalism now, a lot of the liberal media is for people on the internet. It is for college educated people who live in cities, and for people that don't fit into those neat boxes, we don't really have much to say to you. Even though, you know, they speak on behalf of these people, they say, this is what these people want, but you don't tend to actually hear from these individuals who have oftentimes very nuanced views that aren't strictly Democrat or Republican, but the media just does not know what to do with those people.
And this is at a time too, when the Democratic Party is losing minority voters to the Republicans as well. So it's an interesting moment of kind of realignment. And yet, as you say, there's just not that much probing being done about why or how people are feeling or what the reasons are, or what the thinking is behind all of that.
Yeah, they're really terrified to address that, because for the Democrats and for liberals, there was sort of a self-righteousness of like, we are the party for people of color and for women and the LGBTQ community. And so they took this as like the mantle of like, we're the good guys. But now that that's changing, they just don't know what to say about it, or they're, you know, they can blame Trump somehow. You know, they'll figure out a way to blame Trump no matter what happens. But there's no reckoning with these changes.
It is interesting. We're having such similar trends here in Canada, even though the context is different. And I guess that's where I want to close today, is those of us that are trying to think through, I mean, we need the media, democracy functions on people being informed and taking that information away and making, you know, choices about how we should be governed. Where do we go from here? I mean, these are big systemic financial problems to begin with, but then we also have all of these kind of cultural problems as well. Where do we go from here? It's the million-dollar question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Oh, more than a million. Billions and trillions. So one crazy possibility, I think, it could accidentally save us in a certain way, is that AI, which, you know, is inevitably going to be a bigger part of journalism. In fact, I was, you know, looking at job ads this week and noticed that, who was it, Newsweek? There was some big outlet that was hiring AI assisted reporters. And because of that and deepfakes and the way that AI could be manipulated, I sort of predict that at some point, a lot of us just stop trusting what's on the internet altogether. And there's maybe a return to print and face-to-face, because that is something that is more verifiable. It is a form that we once knew, and that we'll need something tangible to verify information. And maybe through that, we can kind of return to a little bit more of the shared reality that we had up until, you know, the last 10 or 15 years with social media fragmenting everything. Maybe that's a little bit rosy, but I mean, otherwise, I only see these trends continuing. There is, you know, the governments are doing more censorship of social media, but I also worry that they're going to be doing more censorship of news outlets too. So I think the exciting thing is things are really up in the air right now, and they can change. But I see a lot of troubling trends with the way that partisan media is only getting more partisan, and they're trying to cling on to their most passionate base no matter what. You know, one thing that I'd also like to see is back in when he was running for president, Andrew Yang talked about getting vouchers for journalism, for like local journalism, that you'd be able to use to pay for newspaper subscriptions. Because part of the problem is that good news tends to not be free. You know, it's expensive to produce, and people are increasingly not paying for it anymore. So if we had some sort of subsidy that people could actually still have freedom of choice in their information, I think that could help the business model. And, you know, I don't see things getting better if the business model doesn't get better.
The subsidies thing is tricky. Canada has done wide-scale media subsidies, and it has, unfortunately, it seems, really impacted public trust in media. So it is a tricky thing. But to your point, it is a fascinating time to be a journalist, and lots to watch. And appreciate you coming on today to share your thoughts and to talk it through with us today. So thanks so much, Ryan.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Lean Out is hosted and produced by myself, Tara Henley. If you value independent journalism, please consider subscribing to my Substack at tarahenley.substack.com. You can also support our work by reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts.